Wish I was a mole in the ground. I wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. You are listening to KBOO 90.7 FM, listener-supported community radio. It's time now for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Denise Morris, your host for this July 20th Monday. I want to send out a big thank you to the dedicated KBOO staff who, over the last months, have kept the amazing radio produced for our community on the air. Thank you. This morning on the Old Mole, Jan Hawken talks with Sarah Prager, professor of obstetrics and gynecology at the University of Washington. They talk about the two recent Supreme Court decisions on reproductive health care and what those rulings say about our current political climate. Dr. Prager is director of the Fellowship in Complex Family Planning and an abortion provider at the University of Washington and at the Cedar River Clinics. She is a featured provider in Our Bodies, Our Doctors, a documentary film on the work of abortion providers. Bill Resnick interviews David Courtwright. He's a peace warrior, writer, and Vietnam War veteran. David wrote the classic book, Soldiers in Revolt, on the organizing and achievements of the GI anti-war movement. They discuss Trump's ordering of the U.S. military into U.S. cities, including Portland, to dominate the streets and clear out the George Floyd insurgency demonstrators that he described as looters, vandals, and terrorists. We'll end this morning's show with a segment from the archive. We hear Clayton Morgridge from January 2019, a commentary on white supremacy and capitalism, twin evils. Quote, Martin Luther King Jr. famously declared the trifecta of racism, militarism, and capitalism as the great problem facing humanity. Our old mole Clayton Morgridge considers two of these, capitalism and racism, and how, as dominant power structures, they came to be through each other. Clayton Morgridge was a member of the Old Mole Collective for over 20 years. He passed away this past February. I'm Denise Morris for the Old Mole Variety Hour. Thanks for tuning in this morning, and thanks to KBOO members, old and new, for supporting community radio and programs like the Old Mole. Remember, you can find us on the web. Look for the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO's own website, kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour. And now, Jan Hawken and Sarah Prager.
Welcome to KBOO, Sarah Prager.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
As a professor of OBGYN at the University of Washington, you have worked for some time now to train students in the field of family planning, from contraception, abortion procedures, miscarriage management, to pregnancy, labor, and delivery. Many areas of medicine involve moral judgments of various kinds that affect clinical care and access, and judgments often directed at marginalized groups particularly. But perhaps nowhere is moralizing more palpable than in obstetrics and gynecology, the field most associated with the healthcare needs of women. There were two Supreme Court decisions over the past month on reproductive rights, one upholding the rights of religious employers to deny birth control in health plans under the Affordable Care Act, and the other where the court ruled in favor of the Center for Reproductive Rights in Louisiana around requirements for providers. Let's start with the Supreme Court decision on birth control. Tell us what the decision involved and how you read that ruling.
Thanks for asking. It's interesting to have two such important cases involving family planning to be decided in such a short period of time. The contraceptive case really was looking to expand the kinds of employers who could choose to not provide contraceptive medicine to their employees simply because of having a moral issue with contraception. That's really all that it states. What the ruling actually said was that certain employers can do that, but the ruling also pushed the decision back down to the lower courts to figure out if this particular case had enough standing to deny coverage to these particular employees. So it wasn't really a final decision. It pushed the final answer back down to the lower courts.
In the film, Our Bodies, Our Doctors, we'll hear more about that later. You've spoken about religious control over healthcare decisions. How is this part of that larger problem in terms of religious control over healthcare in this country?
It's a great question. And the particularly Catholic hospitals or healthcare systems are able to deny certain types of services because of the Religious Freedom of Reproduction Act, or I can't remember exactly what it stands for, RFRA. And what this basically does is it puts in the primary position religious freedoms and puts human rights and those individual freedoms actually below religious freedoms. So in a lot of Catholic healthcare systems, the ethical directives that come down from the bishops actually are able to supersede what would otherwise be standard practice of medicine. And sometimes they can deny services for really urgent healthcare needs to women, including providing care for ectopic pregnancy, as well as contraception or abortion care.
So are there parallels of this sort where employers have been able to deny legally and medically proven forms of care to patients?
Yes. So one of the problems with this power that the Catholic Church has with Catholic healthcare systems is that so much of the country actually now has a Catholic healthcare system predominating. So it's about 12 to 15% of hospital beds in the country are owned or controlled by the Catholic Church. And for instance, in my state, in Washington State, 45% of hospital beds are controlled or owned by the Catholic Church. So it gives women not a lot of opportunity to actually choose to participate in care in those systems or not, because that might be their only option. And this creates a lot of confusion for women because these policies are not often well displayed or well documented when they're signing up for care. And we see that now with some of these rulings over the past couple of years with trying to dismantle the Affordable Care Act, that not just religious institutions, but also non-religious institutions are now trying to be able to deny healthcare coverage for certain women's healthcare aspects, primarily contraceptive medical access, simply because they morally are opposed to that.
And that's sometimes described as the conscience clause. And of course, conscientious objection has a long and proud history in the anti-war movement and other areas of life and is important to protect in some areas. How is it different here, this idea of withholding a service based on moral objections?
Well, Jan, really the primary way that it's different is that when it was first conceived around military conscientious objection, it's the powerless person, one individual person, going against the powerful, which would be the government or the military body, saying, I object because of my moral or religious grounds for participating in this military service. In this instance, you have the powerful, which is the organization or the company or the church or a university, saying, or a hospital saying, we are not going to provide this service because we morally object, thereby making irrelevant all of the thought processes and morals and religious beliefs of their employees.
And this is particularly problematic in that so many people get their health care plan or have health care through an employer-based plan, including under the Affordable Care Act.
Absolutely. I mean, the whole system of having healthcare be derived from somebody's employment began in and after World War II, when there wasn't actually money to give people any additional benefits. And so they had to come up with non-salary benefits. And one of the ways they could do that was through providing job-related health care. That system now doesn't really function well because it leaves out so many people who are either self-employed or underemployed or unemployed. And the other part of that problem is that even for people who have employment, it's not like they're going to pick their employer based on whether or not they're going to be giving them certain specific healthcare coverage. They often don't even know what their healthcare coverage is going to be until they are employed. And what happens in a system where an employer can just choose to say, I am going to make contraceptive benefits not a part of your healthcare benefit, it's really just gender discrimination, in my opinion. Because what it's saying is that these healthcare benefits for which these employees are paying are going to exclude this one part of only women's healthcare that is so critical for women's health and well-being. And there's just really no rational reason to do that other than to discriminate.
Given that the fight over contraception was won some time back, most Catholic sexually active women use birth control. Something like 90% of the population supports the legal right to contraception methods. Why are we fighting this on this particular front, given that that battle seems to have been won long ago?
I see this as an extension of some of the other conservative radicalism that we're seeing happening in this country. And you're absolutely right. These do feel like battles that we, quote, won long ago. And part of the problem is that now there is a sense that these are battles that were won. And so many, particularly younger people, don't either appreciate or understand that there are rights that could be taken away because they never had to play a part in actually gaining access to these services. I think just like we're seeing a huge backlash against people of color, we're seeing a huge backlash against women. And I just think it's part of this radical conservatism that is not a majority of our country, but a very, very vocal minority.
Well, in the other recent Supreme Court decision this past month, conservatives moaned about a setback and that they lost on the Supreme Court ruling when they struck down a Louisiana law that could have left the state with a single abortion clinic. How happy are you with that decision? Is that anything to celebrate?
That's a great question. And the answer is there's a little bit to celebrate there, but unfortunately, not that much. This case in Louisiana was exactly the same, not similar to, but exactly the same as a case that was decided by the Supreme Court just 4 years ago in 2016. So there's no reason to think that what was decided in Texas shouldn't also be true in Louisiana. The only thing that was different was the composition of the Supreme Court with two new, more conservative members of the court. So this case came before the Supreme Court, and truly it was only Chief Justice Roberts deciding to side with the more liberal justices that, yes, indeed, this case was decided 4 years ago. And even though I don't agree with that decision 4 years ago, we said that this was the way it goes, and I'm not going to change our mind 4 years later. In fact, in that same decision from Chief Justice Roberts, he also basically asked for people to come up with other restrictions to abortion care that are not exactly the same to these restrictions that were deemed to be undue burdens, because those potentially could be legal. So I think it was something of a backhanded victory, if you will.
And part of a path that's being pursued toward not only overturning Roe v. Wade, but also dismantling many other reproductive rights that are particularly important for marginalized women, women of color. And it's always been the case that marginalized women have had more barriers around access.
That's absolutely true. And it's no question that given how much vitriol we're seeing right now against people of color and other marginalized communities in this country, that we're seeing also more vitriol against women. Because, as you mentioned, especially within the realm of obstetrics and gynecology, which is 100% women's healthcare or healthcare for women who have some genetic female parts, then there's no way to ignore the fact that maternal mortality is much, much higher for people of color. And reproductive health access plays a huge piece in this. When women can't access contraception, they are far more likely to have unplanned or unwanted pregnancies, and they are far more likely to then need abortions. What we've seen since the implementation of the Affordable Care Act is that abortion numbers actually went down for the first time in decades. And we had the lowest numbers ever over the past 4 to 6 years. This is directly related to increased contraceptive access that was allowable and available because of the Affordable Care Act. If you put now more and more restrictions to accessing that care, it's going to increase the numbers of unplanned and unwanted pregnancies for all people, but especially for people who are more marginalized, and that's going to include people of color as well as teens.
And this broader campaign for reproductive justice that brings race and class and the work that women and people who bear and raise children, as well as the right to end pregnancies, into the movement, that you'll be talking about some of those issues in a webinar panel this Sunday, July 26, along with other providers featured in Our Bodies, Our Doctors, a film that I directed with a Portland-based team of filmmakers. And we'll be looking forward to hearing from you and other panelists at this event. It's free and open to the public. And not only hearing what you hope viewers get from the film, but also your assessments of the political terrain ahead in the fight for reproductive justice and healthcare as a basic right. And people can learn how to register for the event on the website, ourbodiesourdoctors.com. In closing, maybe say a bit about why you decided to be part of this documentary.
Thank you. Yeah, it was actually a pretty easy decision for me to be a part of the documentary because of several reasons. The first is that as somebody who both performs abortions and teaches abortions and has for years, it's really critical to have a clear and accurate representation of what that actually is about. There is so much mystification, so much misunderstanding about family planning, contraception, and abortion in particular. And this documentary, I think, does go a long way towards dispelling some of those myths and misconceptions. And it really was a privilege to be able to have any part in an activity that would have that goal. So it was really appreciative of the opportunity to be a part of that documentary.
We are honored and grateful to have you part of this, and also to be part of this public launch of the documentary that'll be now available online. Thank you so much for being with us today. This is Jan Hawken talking with Dr. Sarah Prager about recent Supreme Court decisions on reproductive rights. Keep up the good work, and we'll see you on Sunday.
Great. Thank you so much, Jan.
It's a new dawn.
Oh!
That was Jefferson Airplane, Volunteers of America, live at Woodstock. We'll be hearing some more live music from Woodstock throughout the program. Well, next on The Old Mole, we have Bill Resnick interviewing David Courtwright, who is a Vietnam War veteran and a warrior for peace. David wrote the classic book Soldiers in Revolt, and they'll talk about recent use of the U.S. military and the hope for both defunding police and transforming the military into something other than it is today. Bill?
Hi, David Courtwright. Welcome to KABU.
Good morning. Good afternoon.
David Courtwright taught peace studies and nonviolent social change at Notre Dame University for over 30 years. He's written or edited over 20 books. Wrote his first book just after a tour of duty in the Vietnam War, titled Soldiers in Revolt. It's a classic on the organizing and achievements of the anti-war movement during the Vietnam War, especially those who revolted while serving. Later became the chair of the National Committee for a Sane Nuclear Policy, and all the while remained an activist teacher, for example, opposing the Iraq and Afghan wars, writing and advocating for a peaceful resolution in those countries. His latest book, co-authored, is Governance for Peace. We'll be discussing Trump's ordering the U.S. military into U.S. cities on June 1st, including Portland, in Trump's language, to dominate the streets and clear out the George Floyd insurgency demonstrators that he described as looters, vandals, terrorists. The big issue, what can be done to stop Trump from going from this dress rehearsal, should he be losing the November election, to create chaos, calling out his fanatic followers and the Second Amendment people into the streets, and then, of course, to declare martial law. The issue today is how to make sure the military refuse to obey illegal orders, which in the final analysis depends on whether we, the people, organize to oppose Trump military rule and to influence the politicians and the military. Tell Trump that they cannot and will not order the troops out. Tell him that this defies the tradition and the Constitution. So first, David Courtwright, tell us about Trump's action on June 1st. What happened on the ground, and then the response from the politics and the press, but especially the response by General James Mattis, revered military figure, somewhat controversial. Tell us about his rebuke of Trump. Was he heard by the military?
Sure.
Did they listen? Did they discuss it? Is there any chance they will disobey Trump and just not act?
Well, it's an important question you're posing, and it's clear that Trump is less and less popular. He's losing political support. He's trying to grasp to the military and to portray himself as a friend of the military and use that as a way to bolster his standing and possibly try to use the military to prevent him being removed from office. His action there in early June, the stunt that he pulled in Washington in front of the White House. One was to basically clear peaceful protesters, lawful right of Senate, protest in front of the White House. National Guard troops and others forced off the streets, a really unprecedented move. And then takes this walk across to this church right across the street and brings with him General Milley, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and Secretary of Defense Esper, really showing the military. It's a kind of show of force by the president to all of us to say, I've got the military guys on my side, don't mess with me. The use of the military and National Guard troops in the streets is bad enough, although, of course, that's happened often in our history, especially against folks in African-American communities in terms of responding to uprisings against racial abuse. In this case, that was combined with this gesture of trying to use the military as a power play. But really something quite extraordinary happened in terms of the pushback from senior ranks of the military against what Trump was trying to do. And I think what happened was really unprecedented in recent U.S. military history. Never have we seen so many senior military commanders push back and rebuke the presumed commander-in-chief. And as you say, one of the leading figures in this pushback was General James Mattis, Mad Dog Mattis, former four-star Marine Corps general and former Secretary of Defense, and he really strongly denounced Trump in an interview in Atlantic Magazine. Similar renunciations of Trump's use of the military against civilian protesters by former senior military chairs of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and they were Mike Mullen, Mike General Dempsey, Marine Corps Gerald Giles. You also had Colin Powell, former chairman of the Joint Chiefs, and many other military and senior defense and department officials. Trump tried to double down on his use of the military, so he gave the commencement address the following weekend at West Point, and he was greeted by an open letter condemning the, quote, politicization of the armed forces, unquote, that was signed by hundreds of former West Point graduates. So I think that's very significant. And it was not just the top general. There were also senior enlisted officials who spoke out. One of them was the Chief Master Sergeant of the Air Force, Kelly Wright. He's an African-American. He said he was outraged about the president's response and the nation's response to the killing of George Floyd. Amazingly, he said, "I am George Floyd. I am Philando Castile. I am Michael Brown, etc." And then we also heard there were some articles that some members of the National Guard who were called out, who were in the streets, you know, with their rifles pointed at the crowds, some of them took a knee in the gesture of solidarity and support for those who have been killed by police and racial violence, racial abuse. This has really become a hot issue in the military. It's especially significant because a growing number of people in the military are people of color. The latest figures I saw is that more than 40% of the male enlistees in the military are persons of color, and female enlistees, it's a smaller part of the military, but among female enlistees, more than 56% are people of color. So the question of racial justice is directly relevant to many of the people who are in the military itself. And I think there's a couple lessons here. One is we can't assume that the military will automatically be in lockstep with a president obviously bigoted and is using the military in a politicized way that's completely against the principles of the American Constitution. And so that's a sign of hope. And the other is that we as a movement, those of us who are protesting and going out to these marches, and we need to continue demonstrating and demanding for racial justice and stating over and over that Black Lives Matter. We need to understand that the people in the military are not our enemies. Even encourage folks in the military to support the movement. I can speak from my personal experience during the Vietnam days, very much part of the movement, even though I was inside the military. And there were many of us inside the military who, you know, we put on a form and had to do our job for the military. And every chance we had, we would go to peace rally ourselves and be supportive of the movement. And that was partly because people in the movement understood that full veterans were becoming more and more opposed to the war. And we were welcomed, we were supported. That made a huge difference in building the overall anti-war movement. When people began to see that even active duty soldiers and recent combat veterans were marching against us, that gave us a lot of public support, a lot of legitimacy, and strengthened our efforts to try to finally end the Vietnam War.
This is Bill Resnick talking to David Cordwright, who wrote the book Soldiers in Revolt. He's done 22 books, co-edited them. He's become a peace and nonviolence activist. We'll talk about nonviolence resistance coming to the end of the interview. David, there are still veterans groups, especially Veterans for Peace, that I know about fairly well, but there are many others who are trying to organize not just veterans, but going to the soldiers themselves. The soldiers themselves come from families all over the United States, although mostly in rural areas. But there has been so much pushback against the Iraq and Afghanistan wars. People sort of understand that the military has been ordered into sacrificing all sorts of lives for very dubious ends. Tell us about the effort to organize the military right now. I'm afraid that unlike in Vietnam, when they were drafted, they were civilian army mostly. This army is an army of volunteers. It's going to be a little harder to get to them, especially in the near term, because the Vietnam War struggles went on and on, and it was a very long war, and And it became increasingly clear that it was not only unwinnable, but unjust. And that radiated out to the military. Today, we don't have that much time, it seems to me, to get to the soldiers themselves. But tell us about the efforts to do that by Veterans for Peace and many other groups.
Well, as you mentioned, there are groups of veterans who are actively reaching out to their colleagues in the military. The most important one is Veterans for Peace, been organizing for a number of decades now, includes veterans from the Vietnam era right through to the Iraq and Afghanistan war, and have been trying to reach out to troops at different bases. And then there's the group called About Face, which used to be Iraq Veterans Against the War. And that's obviously the veterans from the Iraq and Afghanistan war who have been quite active. And so there is a base already to begin to work with the current military. And I think it's important for us to understand that while it is true, it's difficult now for people in the military to speak out because they volunteer, they sign up. But people join the military because they are extremists in some way. Mostly they're joining the military because they need educational benefits. They need opportunity. They need employment. I like to say that there's no military draft, but there is a kind of an economic draft, an economic conscription. We need to be mindful that some of those troops are allies, many of them be people of color, and let's reach out to them and try to build between the social racial justice and the military would naturally support us.
This is Bill Resnick for the Old Mole talking to David Courtwright, who's been a longtime peace activist, nonviolent activist, served in Vietnam, wrote the classic book Soldiers in Revolt. We've been discussing the possibilities of parts of the upper reaches, retired though, of the military, but some who are on active duty now have apparently, particularly people of color, rebuked the president and sent him a signal that if they try to use the military to suppress resistance, if he declares martial law while in losing the election, he would first create chaos in the street by calling out his fanatical supporters and his First and his Second Amendment friends. But if he tries that, it seems he's likely to get more than he bargained for, and he's being threatened by that. Could well be that he will think again, although, of course, Trump, if he's not president, he faces numerous investigations of his very unethical and sometimes criminal conduct as a businessman, no doubt about taxes. In any event, David, it seems to me, in the final analysis, it's the people of the United States who are influencing the politicians. If the people organize, if there's really a recognition that Trump is extremely dangerous and threatens even the limited constitutional freedoms that many of us enjoy and a lot of them don't, if the people organize and are ready in the cities to protest and do general strikes, if that's discussed, it seems to me that that would also reverberate into the military and show that there's popular support for the resistance in the military. It seems to me that's really important. Tell us about that kind of nonviolent resistance that's necessary.
Yes, well, the movement that we're seeing today is historic. There are studies indicating that the movement for racial justice today, the Black Lives Matter movement that has emerged, especially after the killing of George Floyd, is the largest and most diverse movement we've ever seen. And I remember back from the 60s and all through the recent decades, people always said that what we really need in America to achieve progress is a broadly diverse, genuine rainbow movement in which concerned people of all races, of white, blacks, browns, and all of us, join together to demand justice. Today we're seeing that. The crowds that have turned out in these racial justice movements are filled with people, lots of white folks of good conscience who want to support you know, males and my black brothers and sisters. And so we've already achieved tremendous progress. We have a movement of mass participation that is broadly intersectional and diverse. And so we take a long step towards being ready to bring about fundamental change in this country. The key now, I think, is two things. First is persistence, that these movements have to continue. A couple of weeks of protests in June is not going to bring about the necessary changes in America. We have to keep protesting for months, years. The Vietnam anti-war movement went on for 10 years before we finally ended that terrible conflict. Many of the great movements for fundamental change in American life have taken years. So we need to keep up the pressure. The second challenge is equally large and in some ways maybe even more difficult, which is how do we turn all of this energy in the streets into substantive public change? You know, there are some people saying, well, it's a revolution. We're going to overthrow the system and, you know, hopefully can overthrow and change fundamentally the system. But change happens through specific steps, and we have to figure out what are the actions that we need to see in all of our institutions in society. 18,000 local police departments in America, every one of them needs change. You know, we say defund the police. Well, to me, that means let's take the money that we're now spending on the police and devote more to other forms of enhancing public safety and security in our communities, you know, dealing with family dispute problems, dealing with mental health problems, helping with economic opportunity and social equality in our communities. These are all part of the equation of addressing the problem of abusive, racialized policing in America. So demands are out on the street now. The difficult part is to turn it into policy. I mean, even in Minneapolis, the city council, I believe, adopted a resolution calling for defunding the police, but, you know, they've not been able to turn it into concrete results yet. I'm sure they're continuing. That'll be an ongoing struggle. But it illustrates that just calling for defunding or radical change in the police is not by itself enough to bring about the change. We have to figure out strategies and bring in a broad coalition, figure out what are the most fundamental changes that we need in the policing of our communities and what are the functions that are not being met right now in terms of addressing social needs in families and in communities, in neglected communities. Focus our attention on that and get concrete policy proposals that will shift resources from militarized police to greater support for community development, for addressing family and social needs in our communities.
Right, and would you see extending that analysis to the military as well? We have an enormously bloated military. We're spending trillions, actually, on over time on nuclear weapons and more surveillance systems and this entire apparatus of military equipment and training and warships and planes to be able to supply power to control the world, in addition, of course, trying to colonize space for military purposes. It seems to me there's a lot of room, and what has to happen is a tremendous change of first defunding of the military, replacement of some of its functions by various kinds of care and cooperative, people-led services, particularly emergency services for saving people as climate change gets more severe and dangerous. What do you see as the future of the Army?
There are direct parallels between the fundamental changes that we need in policing and so-called security in our own communities here at home and the way in which our military has been engaged in all of these unnecessary wars and aggressive actions and interventions in countries all over the world. And there has been substantial debate, even within the military and among many of us in the policy research community, to try to define a different kind of U.S. international policy. We don't need all of these aircraft carriers and nuclear weapons and all these excessive weapons programs. we could have a much smaller military to actually lift our country and use the resources that we waste on these weapons instead for programs that we know will help to create a safer and more secure world. Most importantly is economic development and humanitarian assistance. Many problems that require greater resources. Also, additional are the increase of armed violence and of extremism and terrorism. Instead of using military means, we should be focusing on social programs development. And, of course, a much greater focus on diplomacy and trying to negotiate with other countries to build partnerships, support the United Nations, support other international institutions to address the challenges that exist around the world. And one of the most dangerous policies internationally now, in my opinion, is this militarized confrontation with China. Those who are in the Navy know full well that a big part of the U.S. Navy now is focused on the West Pacific. And we have, I believe, two aircraft carrier groups patrolling in waters close to the Chinese coast in this show of force, somehow intimidate the Chinese into following the diktats coming from the White House. And, of course, it's complete folly. There's no chance that China is going to be intimidated by us in their own backyard, and it's extremely dangerous. All of that is completely unnecessary, counterproductive. We have differences with China, but we could figure out ways to cooperate. The answer is to find diplomatic ways of addressing our differences and cooperating where we need to on global problems. Just to stay on the China theme, we're dealing now with this horrific pandemic, public health crisis across the entire planet. And our country, unfortunately, has done probably one of the worst jobs. And China is where perhaps it seems to have started, but where they've really done a great job in solving the problem and have so far contained the disease. We can learn a lot by cooperating with Chinese and by cooperating with other Eastern states that are much more successful than we have been in addressing the pandemic. Instead, the president is trying to go it alone and cutting off cooperation with countries, cutting off the opportunity for Chinese scientists and students to come to our country, and not just from China. Cooperation is what we need with the rest of the world. Diplomacy to address our differences through negotiation and conversation rather than threats and bluster. So I see it as parallel to what we need to do here, because we have that same mentality from our policing. What's the answer to these problems? Give them more military equipment, use force constantly, excessively, against unarmed civilians, especially against people of color, and it's counterproductive. It's causing greater insecurity in our communities. We need to end racialized policing and create new forms of public safety and security, genuine security for our communities that don't rely on heavily armed, abusive police forces.
David Courtwright, thanks a lot for your work. Thanks for talking to us today.
Yeah, well, thanks. Great to be able to talk with you, and we hope all our listeners are going to stay involved, keep supporting the racial justice movement, Black Lives Matter, but also get to work on the specific policy changes that we need here at home to ensure that the policing departments are structurally changed, the funds are used instead for supporting community action to address our social needs and community needs. We'll continue to march for justice.
Yeah, I'll be there. David, thank you very much. Okay, so long.
Thank you.
And that was Jimi Hendrix with the Star Spangled Banner live at Woodstock. We're going to conclude today's program with a piece from the archive written by Clayton Morgage. Clayton was a longtime member of the Old Mole over 20 years, and he passed away this year in February. But back on January 21st, 2019, in honor of Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday, he wrote a piece called White Supremacy and Capitalism, Twin Evils. We're going to hear that piece now intact, including the original intro by Tom Becker.
Martin Luther King Jr. knew that racism and capitalism go together. In his commentary today, Clayton Morgage will discuss why capitalism is racist to the core.
Thank you, Tom. By the end of his life, King was an avowed socialist. He delivered a lecture in 1967 calling on the dispossessed of this nation to revolt in nonviolent struggle. Race and racism are not part of nature, but a social construction woven into the fabric of that other social construction, namely capitalism. After all, black people are not really black, and white people are not really white. The words black and white, applied to people, do not mean what they mean when applied, for example, to the stripes on a zebra or to objects like coal and snow. The colors of people's skins vary on a continuum from almost black to very light shades of pink. The words black and white, together with red, yellow, and brown, are used to divide people into distinct social categories called races, with each race assigned a different status in social and economic life. How did this artificial way of categorizing and ranking people come to be? And why does it continue to exist in spite of all the political work done to challenge it over the past 60 and more years? Well, racism as we know it originated with slavery in the American South in colonial times as a way of preventing alliances between poor whites and African slaves. And it continues to function as what W.E.B. Du Bois called a psychological wage, granted to whites. Exploited though they were and are by their employers, at least they are better than the once enslaved black people who continue to be marginalized and underpaid relative to whites. Racism is thus at the service of capital. It prevents working class solidarity and helps keep the cost of labor down. Today, I'd like to do more to show why racism is essential to capitalism. Taken in abstraction from each other, capitalism and racism look like separate issues. Capitalists own and control wealth that can be made to grow by putting people to work, people who have no wealth of their own and who therefore have no choice but to sell part of their lives to capital. The capitalist pays the workers enough, in general, so that they can go on working, as well as support a family that will produce a continuing supply of workers. But after paying wages and other costs of production, there's a nice surplus left over for the capitalist, which he or the corporation can use to further expand production, as well as to finance their lives of luxury. The existence of distinct races of workers does not seem essential to this process. But capitalism did not just spring into being in Europe around 1500. Where did the initial supply of wealth that could be used as capital come from? A major source of the initial wealth that became capital was the silver and gold violently expropriated by Spain, destroying ancient civilizations and enslaving the natives. Then, when too many of the indigenous people died from disease and overwork, they turned to enslaving Africans to work in the mines. And the nation that was to become the behemoth of capital, the U.S., was built on land and resources expropriated from its original inhabitants, most of whom were slaughtered and the rest confined to reservations. This confiscated land then produced great wealth for capital investment and the building of the nation, not by employing workers to grow tobacco, sugar, and cotton, but by violently extracting the labor of people who had themselves been seized and transported from Africa. Yet all this time, the nation was claiming to be a democracy, the land of the free, where all men are created equal. The only way to believe this was to also believe that all men meant only white men. America was thus constructed as a white nation, which meant that everyone else whose land and labor we were seizing was something other than American. So we see that there are two ways that capital can do what it has to do, increase. First, there is exploitation. Capital exploits wage labor. Labor creates more than it costs the capitalist to employ it, and that surplus adds to the pile of capital. But the other way is what philosopher Nancy Fraser calls expropriation, in contrast to exploitation. Expropriation is theft and seizure. The native landscapes where we now live, paying banks and landlords for the privilege, were expropriated, stolen from native people. The nation became wealthy and powerful in the 19th century through the expropriation of the lives and labor of enslaved Africans and their descendants. The ideology of racism, the supremacy of the white man, and the devaluation of blacks and indigenous people was inevitable and necessary to justify and explain this ugly reality, the reality of racial capitalism. But what about now? Now that the nation, that is, its owners, are rich, haven't we outgrown our need for racism? Let me quote Fraser. No one doubts that racially organized slavery, colonial plunder, and land enclosures generated much of the initial capital that kickstarted the system's development. But even mature capitalism relies on regular infusions of commandeered capacities and resources, especially from racialized subjects in both its periphery and its core. Accordingly, expropriation has always been entwined with exploitation in capitalist society, just as capitalism has always been entangled with racial oppression. End of quote. Well, regular infusions of commandeered capacities and resources, especially from racialized subjects in both its periphery and core and its core. Well, what does this academic language mean? Well, it means that populations, masses of people whose skin color marks them as other than white, can be treated as if they did not have the rights to fair treatment that at least in principle white workers have. Besides the territorial conquest and enslavement of the past, there are more modern forms of expropriation. Prison labor, transnational sex trafficking, corporate land grabs, foreclosures on predatory debt, think of subprime loans, and segmented labor markets, enabling employers to pay workers of other races less than a living wage, which is a way of stealing from them. So racism and capitalism are entangled because capital always needs more than the profits it can get from the relatively honest bargain it makes with wage workers. Capital also needs to steal, to seize, to expropriate. The category of race makes this possible. Quoting again from Fraser, race emerges as the mark that distinguishes free subjects of exploitation, citizen workers, from dependent subjects of exploitation, unquote. Political powers support capital accumulation in part by fabricating at least two distinct categories, that is, races, of subjects, one suitable for expropriation, another for exploitation. Racism and capitalism are two aspects of one system of domination, the system of racial capitalism. So the movements against racism and capitalism, as Martin Luther King said, must be one united movement. I'm Clayton Morgridge for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Freedom, 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 freedom. Sometimes I feel like a motherless child. Like a motherless child, along
free to you mean?
What's whatever. Free to me?
Yeah.
Same thing it is to you. You tell me.
No, you tell me. No.
It's just a feeling. It's like, how do you tell somebody how it feels to be in love? How are you going to tell anybody who has not been in love how it feels to be in love? You cannot do it to save your life. You can describe things, but you can't tell them. But you know it when it happens. That's what I mean by free. I've had a couple of times on stage when I really felt free. And that's something else. That's feeling something else. Like all, I'll tell you what freedom is to me. No fear. I mean, really, no fear. If I could have that half of my life, no fear. Lots of children have no fear. That's the closest way, that's the only way I can describe it. That's not all of it, but it is something to really, really feel. Like a new way of seeing. Like a new way of seeing something.
That was Richie Havens live at Woodstock with a clip from Nina Simone, 1968, in New York, talking about what freedom means to her. Well, thanks for joining us this morning on The Old Mole. It is a collective labor that brings you The Old Mole Variety Hour every Monday morning at 9 a.m. on KBOO. I want to thank Jan Hawken, Bill Resnick, Sarah Prager, and David Courtright, both our guests this morning, and thanks for joining us. We will see you again next week.